Sam Stashko, The Athletic, joining us now. Sam, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on, Glenn. I appreciate it.
Always appreciative to bring you on the program. All right, so let's just get some initial impressions on the year that has been Austin FC, capitulated by last night's result over FC Dallas.
Yeah, I think a really impressive season. We saw some signs towards the end of last year, especially after Driussi came in. The attack started to click a little bit more. They caught a couple of good results, and you're like, okay, they have everything in place off the field. Now it seems like the pieces are starting to come together a little bit more on the field. What is this going to look like in 2022? And, you know, they've been really, really solid. I think they've certainly outperformed expectations, as they are happy to let everyone know with their constant tweeting about the experts' predictions from preseason. but yeah, it's been a good year. I think in some ways, maybe they've overperformed a little bit when you look at the underlying metrics. But Sebastian Driussi has been fantastic. They've gotten good performances from other guys. Diego Fagundes, to me, is one of the best stories in the league with what he's been able to do down there after kind of hitting a lull in New England. Brad Stuver's been excellent. And now they go to LAFC having, you know, two good results against them from this season. And I'm sure they feel very confident about their chances.
Let's go back to Sebastian Driussi, because, you know, having this show in Austin, you know, I watch all the Austin games very intently. I watched last year. Before we move on, that's a guy that makes others shine, including Fagundes. Did you see that? Look, we saw he was a talented player when he came last year in the summer, but once he got a little bit more acclimated to the league, did you see him becoming this dominant in year two?
Maybe not quite this dominant, but I thought he would be a star. I thought he would be, you know, best 11 caliber. And I would say that things have gone a little bit better than I thought they would. But you saw it last year. This guy has the talent to be one of the best players in the league, and that's what he's done. And he's really elevated the entire squad, because, Glenn, if you think about it, and you look at Austin's roster and the guys that they've paid transfer fees for besides Driussi, Redis, Pochettino, Kolmanic, Gite, Romagna, Dominguez, Valencia, some of these guys are gone now, but none of them really start. And they've spent a decent amount of money on those guys. They've done well with other acquisitions within MLS and through the draft. But Driussi has really elevated that team in a massive, massive, massive way. And I think it just kind of goes to show the importance in MLS of getting your biggest star signing right. And if you can do that, then you can make mistakes elsewhere and you can still end up okay. And in Austin's case, much better than okay.
Sam Stashko of The Athletic. All right, so back to Driussi. You know, what astounds me about him is basically this guy morphs into something in different areas of the field, right? He's in midfield. He's a midfielder. He can open a game up with his range of passing. In the final third defensively, in front of Stuver, he's defending. He's got a work ethic. He's heading away corners. In the final third, he can turn into a center forward and attack crosses as good as anybody in the league, in my opinion. His aerial prowess is pretty amazing.
It is. I was gonna mention that. It's wild because he's not a big guy.
No, it's amazing. His timing, the positions he gets in. I would even say, you know, when he's stopping and starting, change of direction, all these things. He's got so much in this toolkit. Is there anybody comparative to him in the league right now that does that much in that many different areas of the field?
That's a good question.
Because it's funny, you know, people are, oh, he's a playmaker. He does a hell of a lot more than attacking third.
It's a good point. There are a lot of guys that do a lot of those things, but I'm not sure there's anyone that does as many. Like Hani Mukhtar for Nashville does all of the attacking things that Driussi does, with the exception of maybe the aerial stuff. But he's not, you know, asked to do the same amount of defensive work that Driussi is. Jose Cifuentes with LAFC does a lot of kind of the midfielder stuff, does a lot of the defensive stuff, but maybe isn't quite as involved in the attack as Driussi. So I don't know that there would be another player. Carles Hill, maybe from last year in particular, but again, not dropping as deep, not doing the protective defensive work that Driussi does. Certainly doing all of the attacking things. But I think he's pretty unique in that way. I think that's a good point.
Yeah, he's remarkable. He is so much fun to watch, and he does make others better. Sam Stashko of the Athletic. All right, so the MLS playoffs told us the truth this year. I mean, pretty much, right? I mean, we've got the best teams in the league here in Austin FC, LAFC, and then Philly and New York City FC. So it's kind of proven out, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a rare thing. You know, I think two number one seeds haven't made MLS Cup since 2003 in MLS. And obviously there's another step to go. We don't know exactly how it's going to play out, but LAFC and Philly, the two number one seeds, are both alive. You know, I actually went back earlier and I tallied up the last 5 years of MLS point totals. And the top three are LAFC, Philadelphia, and then New York City FC. All three of those are in the final four. Obviously Austin not in that conversation because they're only been around for 2 years. But you know, I think it's appropriate, and it's not something we usually see in MLS where chaos is usually ruling the day.
Sam, remember, you're not allowed to use final four. The NCAA is going to get mad at you now. Be careful there.
It was lowercase. It was lowercase.
I hear you. Sam Stachkula of The Athletic. I was impressed last night with the evolution of Austin FC in the playoffs, even though it's been short. But I thought organizationally and discipline, and this was something that Josh Wolf was echoing a lot. He even said that at halftime when he was interviewed. I thought that side of their game was pretty good.
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. You know, in the first half, Dallas didn't really show up, I thought. But even still, the two goals Austin got were like really opportunistic goals. Like Brandon Cervania doing a poor job of clearing a corner kick on the first one and Gite taking advantage. And then Alan Velasco with a bad turnover and Drewsi making some magic on the second. So they're super opportunistic. And then they just kind of shut it down. You know, they weren't pressing like crazy. It was kind of defend in more of a mid or lower block and make Dallas break them down. And Dallas, by and large, couldn't really do it. So I thought they did a really nice job defensively. I thought it was disciplined, which was nice to see. It was mature. That's, I think, the word I would use for it. And in front of a crowd like that, to be able to kind of slow things down and not get carried away, I think it can be difficult. And Austin did a nice job of it.
Yeah. And in year one, I remember Josh Wolf saying that, you know, sometimes because of the crowds, it really teased his players into doing more than they needed to do at times and over, you know, getting a little bit over emotional. I think one of the stories we saw in these playoffs games is answering the bell and how important that is. And I thought this was a game Austin FC had to take a lead and win a game as opposed to keep going to the well of coming back. And then, of course, Montreal did not have the best of starts either. So I guess the margins are slim here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Austin, I thought it was a big improvement from the first round against RSL when I thought the moment almost got them, you know. It looked like they weren't really ready for a playoff game. I actually picked RSL to win that game for that precise reason.
So did I.
And you saw it. It almost played out until they got the red card. But yeah, to your point, Montreal, the margins are super thin in any single elimination match. They go down early. Then they actually outplayed New York City for large stretches of that game. Certainly the entire first half, Sean Johnson makes a couple big saves. Kai Kamara hits the post. And NYCFC makes it 2-0. At the end of the half, they scored on their only two shots of the first half.
Incredible.
They converted both of them, and Montreal had free header after free header, and they couldn't quite get it in. So yeah, it's these games are really thin margins. And when you have really thin margins in an MLS game, you want difference makers. And Austin have two in Drewsi, certainly, but also in Stuber, who's been pretty immense for them in this run.
Either end of the field, Stuber's a great story. The value of making those around you better and great goalkeeping so important in the playoffs. Let's take a look at Philly. I thought Philly may have survived a little bit. They did not look particularly sharp. They survived. That's the good news. They got a game under their belt heading into their match now with New York City FC.
Yeah, I'm going to be really curious to see what Alejandro Bedoya's status is, because I think he's so important to what they try and do. They obviously, Philadelphia, for those who do not know, went on a massive, massive run late summer where they won like 10 games in a row, and it felt like they were winning every game 6-0. I think their goal differential.
They were the Man City of MLS.
It was unbelievable. I think their goal differential in 11 games at one point was like 43-9. Crazy. Like they were just blowing everybody away. But yeah, to your point, they had a tough fight against Cincinnati, who was the only Eastern Conference team that Philadelphia did not beat this year. heading into that match. So I think they knew it was going to be a tough game. It was sloppy. It was ugly. It sort of felt like at one point that both teams were going to start picking up rocks and start just literally throwing them at each other. But they're scrappy, and they've been through kind of the playoff wars now a little bit as a team. They haven't gotten farther than the Eastern Conference final, but I think they're sort of poised to do it now. They've suffered, to use that soccer cliche, enough. I think they've got that experience under their belt. And I think their game against New York City is going to be really interesting. A contrast in styles, for sure. But a rematch of last year's Eastern Conference final at Philly again. The Union lost last year, but they had basically their entire team out because of COVID. So this year, that presumably will not be the case. And I think they'll like their chances.
Sam Stachkal of The Athletic joining us here. Hey, I'm interested, and I'm very excited about the youthful nature of these managers now. So you got Gerundolo in LAFC, Josh Wolf in Austin. You got an interim coach, Nick Cushing in New York. And then in Philly, I guess you got the dean of this group of four coaches and Jim Curtin. So I'm absolutely loving seeing these younger managers achieve and get things done and bring some new personality to Major League Soccer from the management side.
Yeah, it's been nice to see. And even you look at some of the teams that were eliminated in this last round. Wilfred Nancy, who's probably going to win Coach of the Year for Montreal just in his second season. Nico Estevez in Dallas doing a nice job. Pat Noonan with Cincinnati going out to Philly. And then, you know, Greg Vanney's been around a bit, but he's by no means an old man. so yeah, I think it's good to see. And a lot of these coaches really try and play decent soccer too. Sometimes I think to a fault almost. Sometimes I think it's not so pragmatic. I think Dallas maybe fell into a little bit of that from time to time this season. I think we've seen Austin fall into it at times before as well. But I think it's still a noble and admirable thing to try to do. And so I'm in support of that. And yeah, all four of the coaches remaining have done a really nice job. Cushing is an interesting one too, because he took over midseason for the MLS Cup winning Ronnie Dela, who went to Belgium. And it was bumpy for a bit, but they've figured things out really nicely down the stretch.
And his background is a lot of women's football in England, which is also very interesting. Comes from the Manchester City system. All right, before I let you go, you're off to, now is it Qatar, Qatar, or Qatar?
You got it, the first one, Qatar.
Okay, that's what I'm told from my friends in the Middle East. Okay, so.
Yes.
So everybody's saying Qatar and Qatar. You're all wrong, and we're elitists here, and we're correct.
That's right.
All right, so tell me a little bit about it logistically, because there is a little bit of an unknown, a Winter World Cup. There's a lot of different things going on. You and I had a little chat before we got on the air. Kind of what's your thoughts on heading over there to cover this? I'm sure you're excited, that's for sure.
Yeah, certainly excited. This will be my first World Cup, so I'm pretty over the moon to be able to be there. Obviously, it's going to be a little bit different being in Qatar, being in the winter. The games will be closer together than in any previous World Cup. The group stage is shorter for every team than in every previous World Cup. So I think that will play a little bit of a role. But then I'm just really curious to see what it actually looks like on the ground. You know, Qatar is not a very open or free society. Most people listening to this, I'm sure will have heard about the human rights violations and all of the deaths for migrant construction workers there. That it's not a good scene. Of course, there's LGBTQ, anti-LGBTQ laws. And so I don't know how these things are going to play out. Women are not especially free in their society. So I don't know how it's going to look. I don't know how it's going to play out. I don't know what the fan makeup is going to be. Logistically, they don't even have enough hotel rooms. It seems they've been encouraging people to, you know, stay in Dubai and take like kind of shuttle connecting flights for 45 minutes. And come in on game day and just go to their games. So all of that is going to be different and
alcohol,
there will be some, but like, it'll be kind of hard to get and you might get thrown in the drunk zone and no one really knows what the limits are there and or what that really means. So there are a lot of unknowns. I think from a sporting perspective, it has the potential to be really cool. Like if you're a fan, you can go to multiple matches in a day, because all of the stadiums are relatively close by to each other. That is amazing. But all of those other factors that I just kind of laid out there, it's potential to get tricky and potentially even dangerous for some people, which isn't great.
So in my years of doing like World Cup qualifiers in different places in Central America and events down there, you know, you always got some pretty strict rules and regulations from networks as to what you could do and couldn't do as far as leaving the property and the hotel compound and things. So have you gotten any of those kind of rules from the Athletic? I'm sure you're getting briefed.
Nothing like that. But you know, like we'll have burner phones and computers that will be only in use in Qatar. So I'm not bringing the phone, the devices I'm talking to you on right now with me and leaving those behind. So there's, I think, more cybersecurity concerns than on the ground concerns, but the Athletic, you know, is owned by the New York Times. And so the New York Times is providing security for all Times and Athletic reporters who will be on site. Which I think is a pretty normal thing for an event like this, regardless of where it is, but that's certainly an element of everything going on. So we'll see how it plays out. Hopefully everything goes smoothly. Hopefully everyone has a good experience and hopefully we can focus on the stuff that's going on the field. But there are also a lot of, you know, less than free elements in Qatar and people that are discriminated against and who don't have rights like they do in other parts of the world. And that's not good.
Sam Stashkill of the Athletic joining us. Sam, will you stay in Qatar or will you stay? Yeah. You most likely have
because
you're going to be on a daily basis.
I'll be there going to US training every day, pretty much going to all the US games, maybe sneaking in a few other games, maybe some Canada games, actually, potentially I'll be covering some of those. So we'll see exactly how the schedule plays out.
All right. Last one before I let you go. You know, I look at a guy like Walker Zimmerman that's not playing games right now. Mm-hmm. Apparently cemented in as one of the center backs.
Aaron Long as well.
I mean, this is a really, really tricky World Cup when it comes to form. Do you think we might see some really big surprises just based on, you know, players that are able to continue to play in league games up until a week away from going to Qatar? Or, you know, I mean, I just think of some of the challenges Greg Berhalter specifically to the U.S. is facing.
I mean, there will be injuries between now and the start of the World Cup. I think that's a certainty. We saw Tyler Adams didn't play this weekend for Leeds. That seems like it's a minor thing and that he should be back. But there's a question whether Chris Richards, who's another U.S. center back, will recover in time from his injury. You know, we saw Raphael Varane go down for Manchester United over the weekend. He's obviously a French international. So will he make the World Cup? England has a few players that are injured right now. So there will be some injuries that could shake things up, but I don't think other than that, we're going to see any huge surprises on the US roster. In terms of form though, to your point, everything is going to be very up in the air. The US, even if the center backs were playing and doing well in their leagues, that position would still be a huge question mark for the Americans at the tournament. Same thing with striker, you know, Jesus Ferreira, like seems like he might be Berhalter's preferred option. Dallas lost to Austin last night. He's not going to be playing any more games for the next month between now and when the US opens against Wales. How will that affect him? So there are big unknowns there. But the big one that I'm keeping an eye on is really injuries, because that has the potential to sink the US team, depending on if a guy like Adams misses. Because he's so important to what they do.
I can't even imagine him not being available.
Yeah, it'll be bad news.
Yep. Sam, as always, thank you very much. Enjoy the World Cup. We appreciate your coverage. Sam Stashkill of The Athletic. Sam, thank you as always for coming on the program.
Thanks so much, Glenn. Have a good one.